I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This afternoon, George Zimmerman is expected to plead not guilty to the second-degree murder of unarmed teenager Trayvon Martin in a gated community in Sanford, Florida. The second-degree murder charge surprised many legal experts when it was announced yesterday. We're going to have more on that in a few minutes. But first, we want to get continuing reaction to this story in the black community. And we turn to Clarence Page, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And Clarence, we're told even the family and the legal team were surprised by the charge. They see it as meaning the prosecutor means business. Your thoughts on what you're hearing?
I in fact, just happened to be with Reverend Jesse Jackson last night when news of the verdict came in. And I think he spoke for a lot of people when he said that this should not be viewed as a victory because it is simply justice, what the family's been asking for all along, that Zimmerman be arrested so that this can be fully investigated. So there's a sense that, yes, justice is being answered so far. The question of the murder charges, that's about as strong as you can get if you don't have proof of premeditation.
Right.
I don't think anybody's charging premeditation here, but these are strong charges.
Well, some analysts are saying that Florida's stand your ground law is going to trump that charge, and that may even be the prosecutor's plan, you know, to go after that law. And we're going to take that up in just a couple of minutes, but let's talk about race and this story. I mean, you've written that this would just have been, you know, a local story were it not for the racial angle, were it not for the fact that Trayvon Martin was black. Have I got you right on that?
Well, yeah, because this, as I began to look into the story, I found all these other stand your ground type cases, similar circumstances, but where race was not an issue because the victim and the shooter were of the same race. In this case, especially with it being a teenage victim with no criminal record, we see an emblematic situation that looks like the scenario African Americans are talking about all the time, which is racial profiling of a kid to be suspicious, a potential criminal, when actually that's not the case. And in this case, a young man is dead. So there was a very strong national reaction from African Americans of all income groups and of all regions, because this really struck us a strong cultural nerve.
Well, from whites as well. And just a quick question, do you think that there should have been some sort of hate crime charge given that?
They've got to have evidence of a hate crime, meaning that bigotry has to be a factor here, and that evidence is not right up front. He wasn't wearing a swastika or a hood or something.
Or Clarence, I got to ask you, maybe wasn't a bigot, and that brings us to something we're hearing today, more than in past days. You know, earlier we reached Tremaine Lee. He's the young African American reporter for the Huffington Post. He was one of the first reporters on the story before it went national. Unfortunately, he was on a train; we could barely hear him, but what he did say is that this started as a case of racial profiling, as you just said, but he feels it's much broader now, that it's, you know, more of a, I don't know, a look at the national consciousness. And he says it is possible that this might have happened to a white child as well. And he pointed to Trayvon Martin's mother's comments yesterday saying this isn't a black thing or a white thing. And today on the Today Show, she was asked what she would say if she saw George Zimmerman face to face. She said, first of all, she'd ask for an apology. But then she said this.
I believe it was an accident. I believe that it just got out of control and he couldn't turn the clock back.
And Clarence Page, is there a little bit of a shift going on, a sense of, I don't know, we want to make it broader?
I think, you know, we've got some conflicting narratives here as to what the family was asking for in the first place and what those of us in the outside world are looking at.
Yeah.
You know, I'm the father of a 22-year-old son with dreadlocks who gets profiled, and I've warned him in advance about, you know, watch out for this on the street, et cetera. This is the kind of thing that goes on in African-American households. So immediately, because you had a shooter who was not black and a victim who was, that immediately triggered this narrative that the rest of us imposed on this. The family, all they wanted was for Zimmerman to be arrested so that this could be investigated.
Right. Well,
and now they've got that. So I think that's why you hear her saying, no, I don't think she ever charged a hate crime in the
right.
first place. But a lot of the rest of us said, looks like it could be a hate crime.
Well, and we're hearing commentators today say that Trayvon Martin's family and legal team should think of including white supporters at their appearances to signal that there is some, you know, there is broad support. And then also hearing that, you know, during the trial, some of these things we've heard anecdotally about George Zimmerman are going to come out, if there is a trial, that he had black neighbors who asked him to watch their homes, that he spearheaded a fundraising drive for a black homeless man. And the thinking is that if this is sort of positioned as just a trial about race, it allows all Americans not to examine, you know, what they might do in a similar – it allows them to point a finger at one man.
Yeah. Well, like I say, we got two different narratives here. There's a hate crime narrative, and there is the simple, what, young black male is the most suspicious creature on the streets at night scenario. And I think that, that latter one is the one that a lot of us have been thinking about. If you want to talk about hate crime, then that's for your legal expert guest, because a hate crime is only something that enhances a penalty for something for some other violent crime or vandalism or something. If you scrawl a swastika on a synagogue, they can put hate crime on top of the vandalism charge and make them much more serious. So I mean, that's something for courts to decide. I don't think that's an issue in this case. The fact is, this child is dead, and murder has been accused. Now, second-degree murder is the charge. And so that's what goes on in the courtroom. Whether or not the family stands with people who are white or Asian or whatever shouldn't matter in that courtroom. It does matter for those of us in this national discussion outside.
Clarence Page, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much, as always, Clarence.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate. Emily, so take us through the nuts and bolts of this charge. First of all, you know, let's just go to basics. What is second-degree murder?
Second-degree murder is a charge that does not require premeditation, but it does require the prosecutors to show that George Zimmerman had what's called a depraved mind, showing no regard for human life. So that is a pretty high standard in terms of the kind of act he's being accused of committing here.
Wait, a depraved mind with no regard for human life. I mean, what are some of the things that would show that?
You know, if you've kind of gone after someone for absolutely no reason, then presumably that is what triggers that kind of medieval language. But I think the fact that we're struggling with this shows why a lot of people have been wondering if a manslaughter charge wouldn't be a better fit for the facts, at least as we've known them so far.
Because manslaughter means?
Because in manslaughter, you know, you're still obviously accused of killing someone, but the reasons can be less sharp. So, for example, George Zimmerman could argue that he had a sincere belief that he was in danger, and the jury could find him guilty of manslaughter even if they think his sincere belief was unreasonable. It's that kind of middle ground that might be actually easier for a case like this.
And by the way, Emily, what does it mean to you that Trayvon Martin's mother said today that she thought it was an accident?
Well, I thought that was really interesting. I mean, obviously, this is the way that cases are charged up to prosecutors. It's not in the hands of family members. And I could imagine that for the Martin family, there is a sense of great relief that this man who killed their son has been arrested, and a feeling now of perhaps being more ready to think about, if not forgiveness, at least trying to imagine the extenuating circumstances. And so that's what I read in Trayvon's mother's remarks this morning, and we'll just have to see how this all plays out in court. I mean, this is very early stages yet for the prosecution.
Well, what about Florida's Stand Your Ground law? How will that intersect with this charge? And first, let's listen. At yesterday's press conference to announce the charges, the special prosecutor, Angela Corey, was asked whether Florida's Stand Your Ground law will be challenged in this case. Here's what she said.
This case is just like many of the shooting deaths we've had in our circuit. If Stand Your Ground becomes an issue, we fight it if we believe it's the right thing to do. So if it becomes an issue in this case, we will fight that affirmative defense.
Emily Bazelon, many people are saying that in addition to George Zimmerman being on trial and perhaps racial profiling being on trial, the Stand Your Ground law and gun laws are on trial.
Well, I hope that's true, because I think the Stand Your Ground laws are really dangerous. And you know, what Angela Corey said is true. What will happen is that if Zimmerman asserts a self-defense, which presumably he will, there will be a pre-trial hearing at which a judge will determine whether that defense means there should be no trial at all and he should just get off then. And the state will obviously be arguing very hard that that's not true. But when you look at some of the recent decisions in Florida, it's pretty alarming. There was a man who saw someone trying to steal a radio from his truck, and he got a big knife and chased the guy down the street and stabbed him to death. He, last week, a judge threw out the charges against him under the state's Stand Your Ground law.
We have another one. A man was at a fairgrounds, and he got into a fight with someone. He went home, got his gun, went back, shot and killed the person. He was tried but eventually cleared under the Stand Your Ground law.
Exactly. I mean, these scenarios, you get close to, I mean, it's not exactly an execution, but you're getting close to people being able to be very aggressive, because Stand Your Ground means that you don't have to retreat, even when it's reasonable to think that you should retreat.
But what would happen in this case? Would they have to then, how would they fight the Stand Your Ground law while pursuing this case? I mean, how would that work?
Well, there are witnesses who say that they saw George Zimmerman on top of Trayvon Martin, and that would suggest that it was Zimmerman who was the aggressor. And we also know from the 911 tapes that a few minutes before the shooting, Zimmerman got out of his truck and was following Martin. So, you know, there is some evidence suggesting that it was Zimmerman who was the aggressor. The problem for the state will be at least these reports of, according to the cops, there are anonymous witnesses who say that they saw Martin attack Zimmerman or Martin on top of Zimmerman, and that is going to be trickier.
Well, Emily Bazelon, what do you think the chances are that this will go to trial?
That is such a good question. I mean, often when you see a very heavy charge like this, what you imagine is that the state is hoping for some kind of plea bargain, for example, to manslaughter in this case. That could certainly happen. And it could also happen that a judge faced with Zimmerman's self-defense will agree with the initial call that the police made and decide that he can't stand trial. So there are these really interesting variables in this case, and we're going to get a very close-up, very spotlighted national view of exactly how the Stand Your Ground law in particular will play out.
And just briefly, we only have a few seconds, but Clarence Page asked me to ask you, there were not hate crime charges in this case, and as we just heard, you had to have evidence that someone was a bigot. Do we assume that there wasn't a charge because the evidence wasn't found?
That's a really good question. What Mr. Page said about hate crimes is exactly right. I think, you know, there was talk that on that 911 tape, Zimmerman uttered a racial epithet. You listen to it, it's really hard to hear. I'm not sure what other kind of evidence the state would have. It's very hard. This is about someone's state of mind, which is always hard to tell.
Right. Emily Bazelon, legal affairs editor for Slate. The first of many days we're going to be talking about this trial as we look toward it. Emily, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that in the final hours of British businessman Neil Haywood's life, he told friends he feared for his life. Haywood was found dead in his hotel room last November, triggering the biggest political scandal in China in decades. Here's the cast of characters. Haywood was close with Bo Xilai and his wife Gu, both so-called princelings, descendants of leaders of the Communist Revolution. But China's officials now say Gu is behind Haywood's death. Her husband has been forced to leave his post as the party leader of Chongqing, a municipality of 30 million people. Now, were a dead foreigner found in a Washington hotel and the wife of a senator accused, it would also make a splash. But it's hard to quantify just how big a story this is in China. So here to help us do that, Boston University professor and China expert Joseph Fewsmith. Joseph, your forthcoming book is The Logic and Limits of Political Reform in China. Interesting title, because we understand that Bo was something of a reformer, a populist on the left.
Well, he was very definitely on the left or allied to the left. It may have been a cynical alliance, but yes. I don't know that I would call that reform. It certainly is change.
Yeah, well, it is in China, so.
Yeah.
But what is really going on here? I mean, the local government in China originally said that the Brit, Haywood, died of alcohol poisoning. And his family says he doesn't drink. Mm-hmm. There's an investigation. The police start investigating Bo and his wife. And now the Wall Street Journal is reporting that Haywood actually left documents with his lawyer about some of the Bo family's business dealings. He said in case anything happened to him. So do you think that what's happening on the face of this is what the Chinese really suspect? Do they really suspect that there was a bad business deal and Bo's wife really killed Haywood?
Well, this is very interesting because the investigation into Bo Xilai apparently began someplace last October, at least a month before the death of Haywood, an investigation into probably issues of corruption, and that would have been politically motivated to get rid of him. Then you all of a sudden you have this bomb thrown into the middle of
right.
it, and that's apparently what blew the whole thing up.
Well, Neil Haywood advised Western firms trying to do business in China. This is what he did. He worked closely with the couple to get their son into school in Britain, and that son is now a grad student at Harvard. The wife, Gu, was in the U.S. 15 years ago, made a huge impression on Americans in Mobile, Alabama. She helped Chinese companies embroiled in a legal mess in courts there. People called her the Jackie Kennedy of China. Brains, charm, beauty, a lawyer. Do you think it's as simple as a business deal that went bad? What do you think?
It's hard to believe. Basically, I don't think you commit murder over economic disputes. There has to be another level to this story that we're not yet seeing.
And do you think it has to do with the government and the politics? Because as we know, the Communist Party is planning its once-in-a-decade transfer of political power this fall.
That's right.
Bo was, you know, a rising star.
I would think that it has to do something with politics, whether Haywood knew something that Gu did not want to get out of the circles. I don't know, but it's hard to believe that it's simply an economic dispute.
Well, there's another character here we haven't mentioned in this incredible play playing out before us, and that is a police chief in the municipality where Bo was, who fought corruption. He had to flee to an embassy. He said his life was in danger.
It's a fascinating story. Bo Xilai brought him down to Chongqing to carry out this campaign against organized crime. And so they had worked hand in glove, but apparently he went into Bo Xilai in early February and said that there was this investigation and presumably that he couldn't protect Bo. And Bo got mad, removed him as police chief, and a few days later he flees to the American consulate about 200 miles away.
Okay, here's what I'm taking from this, and it's just speculation, but it sounds as if Bo Xilai, who was making a name for himself in a municipality that was fighting corruption and a rising star in the Communist Party, somebody who was on a fast track politically, was about to have something exposed about his own business connections. You're nodding yes. Why isn't he the suspect?
He may be, but the Xinhua announcement said that it was she who was suspected of being linked to this. I think we're going to have to see the way this plays out.
No, we want you to tell us what's going on here.
I'm an academic. I wait till the evidence is in. There may be speculation that Bo was somehow involved. I think that the political resolution was that they have decided that they will not accuse him of that crime, whether or not he is involved. Part of what's going on here is the discussions, the political deal-making, how do we deal with this case? And that's kind of what's taken so long from the time that Wang Lijun fled to the consulate on February 6th till Bo Xilai was removed from office on March 15th until his announcement just the other day.
Right. What does this tell you about the Chinese government?
What is really interesting is this pulls back the curtain. We don't really get to see into that black box very often. And what emerges from this is a fascinating combination of grudges that have been nurtured for years and years, very personal interests, factional infighting, all these tensions that exist within this very elite circle. And it's only when there's, as you're suggesting, a transfer of power and they have to sort it out and you play a game of musical chairs and who doesn't get the last chair?
In other words, there are other princelings
oh, yes.
on the sideline who would be just as happy to have one removed from competition?
Including the heir apparent, Xi Jinping, who is very definitely a princeling.
And does it make it easier for them to help remove this couple?
I would think it would be very awkward for anybody to have Bush, Eli around the table. You can imagine staff meetings with the one person who always says, I disagree. He was a real populist, and in that sense, he was a threat to the political and economic program that has been entrained for three decades.
So it makes it a little easier that he's off the stage
now. Yes.
It's just fascinating. We will have to wait to see. But who knows if we'll ever find out. Boston University professor and China expert Joseph Fewsmith. Again, his forthcoming book, The Logic and Limits of Political Reform in China. Ironies abound. Professor, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Maine is a big state geographically, but it only has a few news outlets. And as of last month, the biggest media company, Maine Today, is owned by billionaire hedge fund manager and left-leaning philanthropist Donald Sussman. Good news for workers at the three papers he now owns. The deal brings an infusion of cash. But what does the deal mean for readers and reporters? Donald Sussman's wife is Maine's Democratic U.S. Representative Shelley Pingree. So how do you cover the boss's wife? Rick Edmonds is a media business analyst at the Poynter Institute. Rick, has Donald Sussman been asked directly if there's going to be a firewall?
Well, it's appropriately a question for him, and I think he's indicated in some limited comments so far that there will be a firewall of sorts, and he's certainly not buying the paper to promote his wife's political career, and I think there's going to be some pretty close scrutiny about whether the coverage is fair. Among other things, it would be kind of bad business to cast some doubts on the credibility of the rest of the paper's work.
Yeah, of the product that he just bought. And by the way, Maine Today Media has three papers, the Portland Press Herald, the Morning Sentinel, and the Kennebec Journal. And at least one editor from the Portland paper says, look, we're going to write about his wife. We're going to write about him if he makes bad business deals. And Pingree says, I don't always agree with everything I read in the papers, and I don't expect that to change. So they're signaling that they don't expect to have any influence over editorial. And you said that wouldn't be why someone buys papers. Why does someone buy papers?
Not to be uncynical. I mean, we usually are a little cynical, but I think people are buying papers now because they think papers are important to city civic life. And if it's their city and they got lots of money, that's something they'd like to do to keep it going and see if they can carve out a little future.
Right. You've pointed out that these papers are coming down in price because they're losing readers, so some people want to keep them alive. You know, give us some examples of people with lots of money buying up papers.
Well, take the most obvious example, Warren Buffett, who already owned a paper in Buffalo, bought his hometown paper in Omaha and some other assets and paid pretty well for it. Now, the Maine paper went for, if I understand the deal correctly, $3.3 million got 75% of the paper, which would mean it's worth less than $5 million, and that's about as low as any price I've seen so far. The other big example just got completed, which was a group of six wealthy Philadelphia area businessmen buying the Philadelphia Inquirer, Daily News, and the website.
And does this include, as it originally, the group included state's former governor, Ed Rendell?
He left the group, and I think the amount of controversy about having both a fairly active politician and one who tends to be as outspoken, hands-on, and all the rest of it as Rendell wasn't playing very well, and he said, I guess you have a point, I'll get out of the way. So he may still have some pretty close ties and have the ear of the owners, but that's a different story.
Well, and you cite another example of when someone who potentially had political influence purchased, in this case it was Newsweek. This was in 2010. What happened there?
Sidney Harmon, who's tremendously successful in audio systems, bought Newsweek for essentially nothing, for a dollar. He unfortunately passed away before much of anything could happen, but his wife at the time, Jane Harmon, had been a longtime U.S. representative from California, and she has since retired and is now the heir to the paper. But during her political career, she was an extremely outspoken advocate for Israel. You know, there's a potential owner influence in how they cover both Israel itself and other stories about the Middle East.
This is something that you will want to follow. Go back to Maine, and again, a couple, small papers, but they cover the state, and new owner Donald Sussman, whose wife is the Democratic U.S. Rep. Shelley Pingree, who's going to be running for re-election. Now, Tom Bell, who's the president of the Reporters Guild at the Portland Press Herald, says the paper is going to consider hiring freelancers to cover her campaign. A commentator there proposed instituting an ombudsman, who can keep an eye on things. What do you think of trying to get ahead of criticism by doing things like that?
Well, I've seen it done before. There was a very protracted lawsuit between the Seattle Times and the Post-Intelligencer. The Seattle Times hired a an independent reporter rather than have its own staff cover that. That's one way to go. I think that's a little tricky to farm out the coverage of an important political story like the one in question to someone else, but who knows, might work. And it certainly would send a signal, as you're suggesting.
Rick Edmonds, media analyst at the Poynter Institute. Thanks so much.
Okay, good talk to you. Thanks.
And thanks to a recent spasm in the culture that included self-help books, TV shows, and official recognition by psychiatrists, most people can now picture hoarding. Homes filled with newspapers, knickknacks, animals. Psychiatrists agree it is a disorder. The third network season debut of A&E's Hoarders series was that network's most watched ever. So it's big, but maybe up next, digital hoarding. Of course, it doesn't have the same health risks, but it's not great for your hard drive and your sense of well-being. In fact, Wired magazine says info-hoarding may be the first psychiatric dysfunction born of the digital age. Joshua Zirkle owns Custom Living Solutions Professional Organizing in San Francisco. He comes to us by way of the National Association of Professional Organizers. So, Josh, how much really do you do with people? Are you helping people organize files in their offices, or is it mostly online?
You know, the truth is, in most cases, I do both. We have yet to shift exclusively to a digital world, so most of my clients are somewhere on the bridge between the two spots. All of them still have some paper. Many of them are increasingly moving towards more digital information, which is, frankly, where I spend a lot of my time with them these days.
Have you met people who, you know, we're hearing about people with 75,000 emails. I mean, have you met people who you're thinking, oh, boy, this is a problem?
I have met some people who this is becoming a real issue for. Some of my clients, especially people in the business world, they're leaning back on some of the habits that they had with paper, where they're just keeping everything because they're afraid of things coming back to bite them, to the point where their hard drives become full of emails and attachments, ebooks, etc., that in truth they'll probably never make use of.
What else are people hoarding?
Lots and lots of media, photos, movies, music files, etc. It's funny, when I look through my clients' hard drives with them and we look through their photos, for instance, they're keeping hundreds or thousands of photos from events that they may not even recall. And the photos that they keep are often ones where they're unflattering or they don't like the person who's in the photo. And it just doesn't make sense to keep this stuff. I have one client who is really into movies, and he digitized all of his DVDs onto his hard drive. And he's keeping movies that he didn't even like. And these things just don't make sense. Get rid of the things that you don't want. They're just getting in the way of the things that you do.
What are some of the practical problems? Obviously, it's going to slow down your computer.
Right. Your computer can get slowed down by keeping your hard drive too full, but you can always alleviate that problem by just getting another hard drive, which is something that I see clients do. But beyond that, the functional problem that I see, especially in the world of business, is that you're not able to find the documents that you want quickly. You're not able to ferret through your email and find that one needle in the haystack. When you start going beyond 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 of a given type of file, you really need to spend time hunting for that one that you need.
Well, and you say, you know, if you're keeping something because someday you might need it, a piece of information, it's much easier to just Google it and get it fresh.
Absolutely true. What you want to make sure is that when you need information, you want the relevant version. And oftentimes, especially if you're keeping old copies of things, they may not be useful to you when you actually go and retrieve them because they're probably outdated.
Well, not only that, we're reading in the Wall Street Journal that David Noel, who's a neuropsychologist who specializes in attachment issues, says that, yes, things might slow down your computer, but too much material online slows down your brain. He says all these pictures and links and folders are demanding some form of energy from your brain, whether you know it or not.
I believe that is completely true. The vast majority of my clients tell me that they are overwhelmed by digital information, whereas they used to be overwhelmed just by the paper that was coming across their desk. Now they're overwhelmed by the paper and the digital information, too.
Well, and, you know, we're reminded that hoarding is considered a form of obsessive-compulsive disorder. Have you come across people, you open their computer, and you're like, oh, my goodness, they have 300 icons?
Absolutely. I've seen this a number of times where, since hard drives are so large now, people just feel like it's okay to continue collecting things indefinitely, and it can become a real problem for people when they don't recognize what their endpoint should be.
It's like the brooms. I always say this. It's like the brooms in Fantasia. Remember when Mickey Mouse was trying to carry the water and the brooms were multiplying? Do you remember that, or are you too young? You're too young.
No, I remember that.
Okay.
No, I remember that.
Well, it feels like that. So many tweets, so many emails. Give us some tips.
The first thing to remember is that you are not obligated to be on every social network or receive every email newsletter or read every ebook.
What?
Really think about how you want to spend. I know, right? It seems the prevailing notion is that we should be everywhere all the time. But the people that I find are best able to manage these things are the ones who decide which things make the most sense for them, which ones they like doing or being on. And that's really the first step, is to choose, be purposeful with how you want to interact with the digital world. And when it comes to what's on your hard drive, what you're actually keeping, really start thinking about which area is driving you the most crazy or feeling the most overwhelming for you. Maybe it's your email, maybe it's the files on your hard drive, maybe it's your digital photos, whatever it may be for you, that's a good place to start deleting the things that you're absolutely positive that you don't want or need.
Well, here's some other advice from professionals like yourself. Practice zero email. Have no email in your inbox. Can't imagine it. Declare email bankruptcy. Delete every unread email. Admit to yourself you're not going to get to them. And tell your 10 best friends and colleagues that if they sent something important, send it again. Unsubscribe to every newsletter and mailing list. And set your spam filter to block more things.
I think those are really extreme. And for most of my clients and the people that I work with, they would never do any of those things because they're terrified that if they were to just delete all the emails in their inbox and declare email bankruptcy, for instance, that they would miss something important. So I think it's more realistic to take a more measured approach and to certainly delete the emails that you know for certain aren't important. Maybe you archive the ones that you're clear that you don't need now, and then you have a strategy for moving forward for the emails that are coming your way.
Well, again, from the Wall Street Journal, see what you think of this. This is, according to professionals, health professionals, when you know you are a digital pack rat, here are some telltale signs. You've exceeded your 7 gigabytes of free space in Gmail. You have to buy more. Deleting anything makes you anxious. You spend more time searching for a file than it would take to download one. We just talked about that. You have dozens of icons. You don't know what they're for. You can't remember all your email and social media accounts. You have flash drives scattered in drawers. As you said, of your thousands of digital photos, most are duds. And you have entire seasons of bad TV shows you have no intention of watching. I think you're going to agree with some of those.
I absolutely agree with those. Those are all really good signs. And I think above all, when your hard drive is full and it's a new computer that has a big hard drive, that's an indicator that you've got too much stuff. And the truth is, it's a good practice to get into, to just like with our paper files, every 6 months or so you go through and weed through what you don't need. The same is absolutely true for our computers and our digital files.
Joshua Zirkle of Custom Living Solutions, Professional Organizing in San Francisco. Joshua, thanks.
My pleasure.
Like it or not, and we do, they're back.
Now look what you've done.
Me? You started it!
Hey, leave him alone.
Shut up!
Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk. The Three Stooges, Mo, Larry, and Curly, as played by Chris Diamandopoulos, Will Sasso, and Sean Hayes in the new Farrelly Brothers film. It opens tomorrow. In it, our hapless heroes try to save their childhood orphanage and inadvertently stumble into a murder plot and onto the reality TV show Jersey Shore, which means we certainly will get to hear them say Joyzy. In this scene, the boys literally run into an old friend from the orphanage who introduces them to the iPhone.
Why don't you watch where you're going, bud?
Mo? Larry? Curly? Is that you?
Depends who's asking.
It's me, Ted O.J. Harder.
Who?
Here, look. I got a snapshot of me and the Rents leaving the orphanage.
Hey, it is you.
Wait, let's get a quick pic first.
What is that gadget?
This is an iPhone.
iPhone?
Hello? Hello? There's nobody there.
Curly, of course, tries to hold the iPhone up to his eye, shouting hello in that scene from the new Farrelly Brothers film, The Three Stooges. Fans are nervous, none more so than our next guest. He's chief Stoogeologist, president of the Three Stooges fan club, and owner and founder of the Stoogeum, the world's first and only museum dedicated to the three lovable knuckleheads. Gary Lassen joins us from Ambler, Pennsylvania. Gary, how are you handling the thought of... Certainly.
sorry. I don't usually do impersonations. I promise I won't do any more. I'll leave them to the professionals.
More. I've been trying to do that thing where you hit your cheek and it makes noise, but I can't.
It doesn't come across on radio.
Well, how are you handling this thought of the boys in the hands of the boys, the Farrelly brothers, who, of course, in some ways it seems perfect because they brought us Dumb and Dumber.
The fans seem to be really divided on this one. About half the hardcore fans think this is just blasphemy that they'd even try to make a movie like this. The other half are very excited about the prospect of the film coming out tomorrow.
Well, and the reviews are mixed. We're just looking at the Chicago Tribune, which just came out a little while ago. Its headline is "The Nyucks, NYUK, outnumber the laughs in the Three Stooges." So there's not as happy there. But for the new generation that didn't sit around on, I think it was Saturdays, watching the Three Stooges, how would you describe them?
I think the best description would be that they were, cartoons with real people. I mean, that's the way I thought when I came home from school every day and the Stooges were on as a kid. They were unlike anything else on television at the time.
And who literally were they? Pair of brothers?
Well, there were three brothers that were part of the act, and Larry Fine, who was not one of the brothers, and several others that came in and out of the act. There were more than three Stooges, so it's not an easy question.
Right. Well, and they got their start in vaudeville in 1925, moved on to short films, 190 in all. And just tell me, what is Stoogeology? I mean, what are you studying?
We study anything and everything Stooge. I mean, we're just fascinated by their history and, their off-screen persona and lives, as well as the on-screen stuff. Films that they made that were thought to be lost are still being discovered to this day. We're still learning a lot about them that we didn't know. And you have to remember that a lot of what they did back then was not documented. The Stooges kept no records like that at all. We have no record of the personal appearances that they made when they went into the studio to film certain things. It's not like today where every little facet of a musician or an actor's career is documented. So we're still trying to uncover a lot about them.
Well, and why are you doing that? Because some people might say, why do they deserve this? These were guys who poked each other in the eye, twisted each other's noses, stepped on the ends of boards and got hit in the face. What else do you see in them?
They did a lot more than that. I mean, truthfully, most people, when they think of the Stooges, clearly they think of physical comedy and the pratfalls. But if you take another look at the films, you'll see that there was really a lot more going on than that, and that they were making some social commentary. There was a lot of clever wordplay.
Here's some of the clever words. I'm doing the elevator dance. Elevator dance? Yeah, there's no steps to it. Ba-dum-bump. Right. I'm the best musician in the country. Yeah, but how are you in the city?
One of the reasons the Stooges hold up is that physical comedy clearly holds up a lot better than verbal repartee. So what was considered witty dialogue back in the 30s and 40s doesn't really hold up so well today.
Well, and yet I hear one of the concerns is that what we're seeing, at least on the trailers for the Three Stooges, is a lot of potty humor. Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the Farrelly brothers are known for that, and of course the Stooges never did anything like that. Of course, when the Stooges made their films back in the 30s and 40s, they were geared for audiences of all ages, and they weren't targeting teenage boys with toilet humor. So that's one of the concerns of the fans.
Well, which is why one of their biggest takeoffs was on Hitler, making fun of him. But let's compare and contrast, shall we? Here's a scene from the original Stooges short film, A Plumbing We Will Go, in which the Chuckleheads pose as plumbers to elude the police and almost destroy a mansion in the process. Hilarity ensues. Let's listen.
Why, you lame brain, you! Look what you did to the pipe! Go on, get another piece of pipe!
I resent that!
What are you going to do about it?
Get another piece of pipe, won't you?
I'm sorry. And here are the Farrelly Brothers Stooges at a fancy dinner party.
What are you grubworms doing?
Getting seconds on lobster.
Seconds? Mm-hmm. I thought lobster upset your stomach.
I dipped it in Pesto Bismol.
Oh, you like dipping, eh?
Yeah. Come here.
Look, it's Santa Claus.
It's, I'm sorry, it sounds as if it's got sort of the
Yeah, I have to say that looking at the trailers, it really does feel like they've tried to capture the aura and the feel of the Stooges comedies. And, you know, as skeptical as many people are about this film, I think if anybody could pull it off, it would be the Farrelly brothers. I think they really, their heart is in the right place. They really are true Stooges fans. They really wanted to do a great job with this film. And I'm sure that they'll have done, you know, done as good a job as anyone could do. It's just that the task is very difficult to try to recreate the aura and the feeling of films that were made in a much more innocent time, 70 and 80 years ago. It's part of what we love about the Stooges is the low-budget nature, the black and white, the cheesy special effects. Very difficult to try to recreate that feel in a modern-day film.
Well, I read one review from a fan who got to see a preview who said, you know, it was worth the price of admission just to see the Three Stooges at the age of 10, which you apparently do in this film. But I just have to ask you, you married into the family. You married Robin Solomon.
Yeah, that was probably my mistake. I married one of Larry Fine's nieces, and that's really what got me started into collecting Stooges and you know, wanting to know more about them.
Well, and we'll let people know more about how they can visit the Stoogium that you've created there in Ambler, Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, what's your favorite episode?
I always liked Punch Drunks when I was a kid. That's the one where Curly sort of went nuts every time he heard Pop Goes the Weasel, and he was able to beat everybody up and become sort of like a superhero just by hearing that tune. And I thought, as a kid, I thought, oh, isn't that cool?
We have a clip. Mo is a fight promoter who discovers Curly waiting tables in a restaurant where Larry is playing the violin, and all is well until Larry plays Pop Goes the Weasel. Let's listen.
You're a born champ. Every time I hear that weasel tune, something pops inside of me.
Hey, what's the idea? You're trying to ruin my business?
I'm sorry. I'm a victim of circumstance.
What do you think this is, a joint?
It's that Pop the Weasel.
Hey, fiddler, give us that weasel tune again.
What happened?
Look.
How'd he get up there?
It worked. Shake hands with your new manager.
Well, Larry and Curly in Punch Drunk, one of 190 shorts the trio made, and one that many can see at the Stoogium. Gary Lassen is curator. Gary, thanks so much.
Certainly.